This week on Potlatch, Morris Thompson comments on the Self-Determination Act, and Joyce Shales talks about education, religion, and culture. What do the music of Johann Sebastian Bach and the music of the Alaskan Kuchin have in common? They're both on Potlatch. Says all the music on Potlatch has to sound alike. That was Sleepers Awake by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Walter Carlos playing the Moog synthesizer. Now, this report from the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
The Indian Self-Determination Act, Public Law 93638, is still a thorn of contention in the Indian community. This law, signed by President Ford last year, was somewhat of a revolutionary mandate, in that it permitted Indian tribes to take control of government services on their reservation and administer federal programs themselves. The law is designed to be strictly voluntary. Each tribe can decide for itself if a certain program would be better administered by its own tribal government or the federal government. It would seem then Public Law 93-638 was the ultimate goal many Indian leaders have been working for all their lives. But the law, once it was passed, has been a source of suspicion and fear for some members of the Indian community. One tribal chairman has said the law encourages Indians to contract out their own termination. He was referring to the mechanism developed by the government for Indian tribes to take over federal programs, contracting. Tribal governments can contract to run certain programs, such as road maintenance, economic assistance, or a multitude of social services. Termination means the dissolvement of the tribal structure. And since termination of Indian tribes was once a goal of the federal government, many Indian leaders now suspect any kind of legislation dealing with Indian people. Commissioner of Indian Affairs Morris Thompson explains how the BIA looks at the Indian Self-Determination Act.
I think what we need to do is to follow the mandates of Congress and the administration in our practice of contracting to give assurances to the Indian community that it's not a disguise for termination of any services. I'm convinced in my own mind that Congress nor the administration intends Public Law 638 to terminate services to the Indian community. I think it's just the opposite. Congress and the administration intended that Public Law 638 strengthen tribal governments and provide them the opportunity, if they wish, with the right of retrocession, to run their own programs, hire their own people, to set their own policies, set their own leave times, for example, set their own administrative policies, and to strengthen tribal governments. And I think that was Congress's objective. We're going to do all we can to ensure that that's lived up to.
Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Morris Thompson. Recently, the Bureau of Indian Affairs came under criticism by a nationally televised talk show. It was said that 99% of the Bureau's budget is spent on administration, while only 1% is spent to benefit Indians. Lynn Ingalls, Director of Public Information in the BIA, responds to that charge by saying, first of all, most of the employees in the Bureau are themselves Indian.
Well, it definitely is an Indian Bureau, and it's getting to be more of an Indian Bureau every day. Of course, we have the Indian preference policy in our hiring and our promotions and our personnel actions. At the present time, about 64% of the employees of the Bureau of Indian Affairs are Indians, and this percentage is climbing steadily. Majority of these employees are working on the reservations and at the agency level directly with other Indian people. I think another thing we ought to get into is the salaries paid to these Indian people that work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's been charged, and there's a criticism made of the Bureau that some people say that the percentage is as high as 99% of the Bureau's money is spent on administration costs, with only 1% of it going to directly benefit Indian people. Let's take the salaries of the 64% of the employees of the Bureau. Those salaries go directly to Indian people. The majority of them live on the reservations. Their salaries are spent on the reservations and help to benefit the economy. That, I suppose, we could call an administrative cost. We could also call the cost of running the Bureau of Indian Affairs school system an administrative cost. But many Indian children are getting an education and a better education each year from these BIA-operated schools. We could also call administrative costs the cost of the social service programs and the law enforcement programs. But don't these benefit the people on the reservation? I think that it's unfair of anyone to make a statement that 99% of the Bureau of Indian Affairs budget goes towards administration. Really, I think we're talking at somewhere around the neighborhood of 6% of the Bureau's budget that actually goes for administrative costs. The rest of it goes for service delivery and delivering programs on the reservation to Indian people themselves.
That was Lynn Ingalls, Director of Public Information for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act has been open for enrollment again to register any Alaska Natives who might have been missed when the roll was taken several years ago. Anyone of Native descent who feels he or she might be eligible for enrollment who is not currently on the rolls to participate in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement, should contact the Alaska Native Enrollment Office in Anchorage, Alaska. This is Tana Beebe for Indian Network News, a biweekly broadcast sponsored by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in cooperation with this station.
Kukke kukke tatsanne tatna liye jeryo khonji Kishe kutsaya khatiti khai na chili
That, thanks to Folkways Records, is the song of the snow goose flying over the mouth of the Yukon, music of the Alaska Kuchin. One of the advantages of producing Potlatch is meeting interesting people, like Joyce Shales, a Tlingit, who works for the Cook Inlet Native Association. She told me what it's like being sent out of your village to have to go to high school.
To show what a drastic change it is, I suppose, I used the analogy of like sending Americans to the Soviet Union. I went to the Soviet Union last year, and I tell you, you don't appreciate home until you've been away from home. And a lot of the kids that are sent outside are put into an environment that's very sterile, and there are many, many rigid rules to follow. You can only go, like at Mount Edgecombe at one time, from what I remember. You could only go to town at certain times with somebody going with you. And nobody in town liked you. There's a lot of prejudice involved, and as long as I can remember, it's been there against the kids that go to Mount Edgecombe. And it's from the townspeople. And I suppose it's not as bad as it used to be. But to send your children to a hostile environment where people are not loving, and they do not appreciate where you come from and what you know and what kind of a life you have, what kind of a background you come from, and all the terrific things that go on where you come from.
Joyce Shales told me what non-natives can learn from Alaska natives.
My father used to tell me all the time, listen, listen so you'll learn. You know, and a lot of times I think we talk too much, just like maybe right now, but there are a lot of things. The food that's up here is, you know, I don't know, my son came home one day and said that the teacher said that the Indians were eating some kind of awful fish that they buried in the ground and came back months later and ate, and he goes, ugh, you know. So, well, yes, that's what happened. And there's a lot of things that we eat that other people don't like. But it's good. You know, those kinds of things. Cultural things, art, you know. We, of course, we see a lot of it because it's profitable, but art is certainly something to be admired and enjoyed. Just as one person to another, to talk to, one of the finest things I find is to talk to some of the old people. Talk to some of the old people and listen to them. They have so much wisdom to offer, and here we are, college educated or whatever, and there's so much we don't understand. I know when people talk about my grandfather, they told me that he could sense, when you're going down a river, he could sense without seeing where the animals were. If he was looking for a bear, he'd say, over there around the bend, we're going to come across two bear in the woods. And they'd go over there, and they'd find those two bear up and down around the bend, and there they'd be. there was kind of a, I don't know, useless sixth sense that we don't have anymore, seemed to have lost. There's a sense of awe in nature and respect for nature that we've sort of lost in the name of progress or the name of whatever. We don't seem to have that anymore. I know if you talk to a lot of Native people and you get them really to trust you and talk to you, and I've talked to a lot of young people around here of AFN and Cook Inlet and at the university, talk of a higher being or higher power the way the Native people used to believe before, as a religion, a valid religion, just the same as Christianity is a valid religion, is something to get people to even admit that it's there, and they know it's there, but they won't admit it because it means, you know, maybe you're not Christian.
Often the Christian missionaries treated the natives as pagans, but what did Native Americans believe in?
A deity, a god, whatever you want to call it. You know, some people call it Allah, some people call it God, some people call it Jehovah, some Native people call it the Great Spirit or whatever. The idea that we were created by something greater than ourselves has been with all mankind. And yet, for some reason, you know, that belief hasn't been able to be really expressed by Native Americans to a degree of people believing that it has a validity, a true value, as valid as Christianity or any other religion. If you talk to some of the young people, they can tell you all kinds of stories that the old folks have told them about spiritual matters. And there's been a lot of talk around here about talking and teaching some of the younger people about spiritual matters by having some of the older people come in and talk to them, because they've been asking, and it's a matter of finding out who you are and where you belong and what you believe. Because as far as Alaskan's concerned, you are what you are religiously by where you were born. You know, if you were born in Southeastern, you're probably Presbyterian or Episcopalian or something like that. If you're born up north, you could be Catholic. If you're born somewhere else, you're Moravian. If you're born somewhere else where the Russians first came and they got the strong, you're Russian Orthodox. You know, it's a matter of where you're born. Native people were here long before the white people came, long before the Russians came, long before the Christians ever came here, and they believed in a higher being. And they need to be able to look at that and respect it. And that's part of knowing who you are. I don't think missionaries ever realize that. It's another matter of being nearsighted. Ethnocentric Christianity was European by the time it got here, and it brought along with it European values. In Hawaii, if you read the book Hawaii by Michener, also brought along woolen underwear to Hawaii. You know, the Native people were supposed to wear that. Doesn't make sense, you see? The idea of Christianity is beautiful, but what came with it didn't always necessarily fit, and still doesn't necessarily always fit.
I ask what traditional Native values had in common with traditional Christian values.
The sharing was an extremely highly held value by Native people. Nobody ever went hungry. You didn't need a state or the government or somebody to tell you, okay, now if you need food, well, you come here and apply and we'll see if you're eligible. The eldest people were taken care of. Nobody had to be told to take care of anybody. Nobody went hungry. And that was a stable culture. I think it's unfair to say that because we have to go find out if we're eligible now that's different. Times have changed, and certainly times are going to continue to change, and we have to change with them, and everybody in the world is changing with the times. Technology has brought about almost the destruction of the extended family. And in America, at least, there is really no extended family. Among Native people, I'm related to half the people in Southeast Alaska. That's an extended family. And that's extremely valuable to me.
I asked how traditional Tlingit culture regards the elder people.
You always respected the older people. You always looked up to the older people. It's almost like, I feel like sometimes when I go into a house and there's older people, they're like, you just like to sit at their feet. And I don't know how to explain that feeling, except that's the way I feel. It's sort of almost a reverence. And I would say probably that, as much as anything else, is slowly dying out, which really is a shame. But I don't know. I've just never witnessed something like that. Even, you know, today, to say who my grandfather is and everybody knows, that's sort of like, you know, the magic word. It's an entirely different way of looking at it, and of course comes from the fact the older people had the wisdom. In the days past, they had the wisdom that was necessary for the younger people to learn all these things, and it's very sad that the older people are not taken care of like they should be in this country. In fact, they're probably the last on the list. They really live a tough life. If you don't have money to begin with, it's really tough. You see a lot of three-generation type families where the old folks and the young people and the children are all in the same family household, which is really kind of nice, and a lot of times it's necessary that the grandparents may care for the children, the younger ones, while the parents work. That, again, is relative. If you're in the village, it's probably more probable that the older people are fairly well taken care of. You get into an urban setting, and then again, it's a real disaster. Like my grandfather, he lives by himself, but he's able to take care of himself, but everybody looks out for him. You know, my uncles bring up all kinds of goodies for him on the boat when they come up to fish. My other uncles may go see him. All the kids love to sit down and talk to him and listen to what he has. They know he has a lot to offer. And this summer, I hope to go down and spend quite a bit of time with him just talking, you know, trying to learn some of the things he knows. Because he was born in the 1800s, so he's seen a lot in his day.
According to Joyce Shales, even those who say they respect Native cultures are often aware only of the superficial aspects of Native cultures.
The most important things are not even spoken about. And the things like the spiritual things, the really deep, important things that are important to every human being, you know, a sense of who I am and why I'm here and where I'm going. Those kinds of things are never spoken about, the things that are profitable, like the art, which of course is beautiful and people can see that and it's saleable. It's a profitable item. Those things go. You know, those things really go. Those kinds of things, arts and crafts, where you can find, you know, soapstone carving. People are willing to do those kinds of things. But to look beyond the outward cultural aspects of Native people is really, I don't think too many people do that. I don't know any other way to say it except that those kinds of things, if you listen to Native people talk, and maybe Native people alone, unless there's people there that they trust, you don't hear them. They're absolutely beautiful, and they're powerful. And I don't mean that in a negative thing. It's a positive, powerful thing. It's a good feeling to know that what your people believed was okay. You know, I'm okay, you're okay, sort of thing. And it's a powerful thing. You can see kids when you talk to them about these kinds of things just all of a sudden sit up, straighten up, hold their head up. I mean, you can see it physically, a change. When fun, you know, somebody, because nobody ever says, yes, these things are good about you, your background, your heritage, your fathers and your fathers before them, they had really neat things going. People don't say that, not often enough anymore. Even if they think it, you know, and maybe even believe it, they don't say it, you know, they don't people don't seem to be aware of those kinds of things. To say them. It seems like to me now's the time to say it because people don't know it. The young people may be ashamed of saying, you know, well, what did the shamans do? Oh, they did this or that or the other. They had a positive power in the community. They could be positive or negative, but they had a positive power. They were the guidance of the people, you know. And if you're talking about maybe even equate like priests were the guides for the Western world, they told the people what they should do, how they should be, you know, how they should act, the values that they should hold, you know. And if the people wanted to be good people, they followed the priest and they did. Yes, they didn't lie and they didn't cheat and they didn't steal. They tried to be good people. The shamans had some kind of, I think, same kind of things. They told the people things that were going to happen that they could foretell. And they told, you know, all kinds of different things, how people should be. Sometimes it was positive, sometimes it was negative. But I believe that they had a certain kind of a real power. And the people then believed it and followed their guidance. You can look back in Native history, Native American history, and people like Daganduwe and Hiawatha. Well, not very many people know that Daganduwe, who was from the East, an East Coast tribe, was like a prophet, like a teacher. He came and he told the people how they should unite the Iroquois nations. And Hiawatha was like maybe like an apostle.
Native Americans are often stereotyped as superstitious. Joyce Shales responds to this criticism.
I think that's probably the attitude that came with Christianity, that was all superstition. But in my mind, it wasn't. There is a lot of superstition, granted. But there's also don't walk under a ladder, don't cross a, you know, in front of a, let a black cat run across your, you know, across your path when you're walking down the road. Hold a needle in front of a pregnant woman's stomach and it'll tell you if it swings one way or the other, whether it's going to be a boy or a girl. You know, I could think of all kinds of things that are superstition that you find everywhere.
Joyce Shale suggests that when some people regard as superstitious may merely be a highly developed extrasensory perception. Here's how she describes this gift.
And I like to use the example of a mirror. And I think that that's sort of that sixth sense or that thing that the shamans or the spiritual people of the past used was like a mirror. It's all clouded up now. You know, it's like it's covered with smoke. But you start polishing away on that mirror, pretty soon it begins to shine. You can see. You know, it's like looking through a window. We don't see it because we don't use it. We put it down. You know, the children say, oh, mama, mama, somebody... You know, I've been playing with this little friend of mine who nobody sees. He said, oh, that's silly. There's nobody there. Maybe there is somebody there. How do we know? You know, it's just so much we don't understand. Especially about, spiritual things, things of sixth sense, souls, ghosts, or whatever you want to call it. A lot of Native people tell you stories about people who almost died and saw something, or who did die and you saw them in a dream and they were okay, or lost in the woods. You know, there's a lot of stories about people lost in the woods and they'd see everybody they knew that had passed on. And they, you know, just strange kinds of things we can't explain.
Gamble, Alaska. Eskimo singers and dancers, concluding Potlatch for this week. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.